The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Separating families at the border unites many in anger.
This was a policy invented, implemented, and executed by President Donald Trump.
Jitters over a potential trade war.
Sometimes these conflicts can get beyond the officials' ability to control them.
Priceless Abraham Lincoln artifacts headed for the auction block.
He couldn't catch a break in the 19th century, and it seems now he can't catch a break in the 21st century.
I'm Bill Rakoff in the CBS News Washington Bureau. Immigration and the separation of families at the U.S. border with Mexico dominated the headline cycle this week with arguments and finger-pointing over who is to blame for the issue and who's responsible for fixing it. In a moment, we'll talk with Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan about the subject. And later, we'll have more with CBS's David Begno at a shelter for immigrant children in Texas. And Omar Villafranca takes us to El Salvador, where many of the undocumented immigrants coming to this country are fleeing poverty and gang violence. But first, this. A mother from Guatemala emotionally reunites with her son after being separated from him last month. CBS's Ouija Jiang has more from Baltimore.
Beata Mejia Mejia says she and her son arrived to the U.S. border after a three-week journey, 2,300 miles by foot. She says they were seeking asylum, fleeing violence in Guatemala and domestic abuse, but she was detained. And for more than a month, Mejia Mejia says she had no idea where her son was.
Beata Mejia Mejia sobbed as she held her son for the first time in more than a month.
What did you tell your mom when you saw her for the first time?
That I love her. Mejia Mejia and 7-year-old Darwin were separated in May after they crossed the border near San Luis, Arizona, seeking asylum. But asylum seekers must go to an official port of entry to enter the U.S. legally, something Mejia Mejia did not do. Mejia Mejia and Darwin were taken to a detention center in Arizona.
Can you describe the moment you realized Darwin was being taken from you?
One day they called him by his name, she told us, and took him away. Mejia Mejia filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday against several government agencies and Trump administration officials seeking a court order releasing Darwin into her custody. On Thursday, the Justice Department agreed to release Darwin.
What are you most excited to do now that you're back together?
I just want to talk to him, she said. It's been so long.
The family's lawyers tell us Darwin claims he received shots while inside that detention facility. He will now get a medical checkup, including a full blood test. Meanwhile, Mejia Mejia is out on bond as she waits for a hearing on her asylum status set for August, and that lawsuit of hers is still open.
That's CBS's Ouija Jiang. Earlier this week, frustration over the separation policy boiled over with Democrat Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland delivering blistering remarks during a committee hearing.
We will not intentionally separate children from their parents. We should be able to agree that we will not keep kids in child internment camps. What country is that? This is the United States of America.
Face the Nation host and senior foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan joins us. And President Trump signed the executive order this week about family separation, but he also called Congress to act quickly, but then turned around and told them in a tweet, on Friday to circle back after November, after the red wave goes through. So is he giving them some cover here for failing to act legislatively?
He's giving them cover, but he's also sending them mixed messages that aren't helping in many ways, because if Republicans were looking for the president to put his shoulder behind a piece of legislation and help them push it across the finish line, they're not getting that. The president hasn't vocally endorsed one of the two bills. He's sent some mixed messages on that, the bills that are being discussed, at least in the House. And then on the Senate side, there's no clear path of action either. So this looks like another Washington fight, but the president has absolutely said it's only up to Congress to fix it, but then Congress don't fix it. And by the way, I can do this, after all, through executive action.
And Paul Ryan seemed to want to will this across the line, you know, saying that, you know, it's his understanding that the president did endorse the two bills that were on the table this week. But again, clear as mud.
Exactly. Well, and endorsing both is not endorsing one to help complete the process, right? There's nothing that he has said is his complete picture of what he would like to see in a final bill. Of course, also, it's worth going back to the idea that the president lifted or tried to lift those restrictions or those protections, I should say, on so-called Dreamers or DACA recipients. That's the other forced crisis that's now tangled up in the courts. So the president has taken actions that he's argued are to force congressional follow through, but then he hasn't helped Congress follow through on that. And to be honest, we're seeing this real divide within the Republican Party. That's one of the things that's so fascinating. And we're going to talk to Senator Bob Corker about on Sunday, is whether or not they can come to a consensus about if this is an issue they want to run on. And is border security a question of security, as the president describes it, or is it more of the pictures that we're seeing of children, of compassion, of people who aren't threats, but rather are victims themselves? And that is something you see them struggling with on messaging here.
Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan is with us. The president also ruffling feathers with his continued threatening tariff talk, and threatening this week on Friday to levy even more tariffs on European auto imports. So some say it's typical Trump, art of the deal type stuff, gamesmanship. But, world markets are teetering here on every tweet.
They are. And this is where, if this is chest thumping and to get a better trade deal, it hasn't resulted in that yet. And you're seeing the financial markets now start to reflect a worry that they'd been brushing off before. June 20th is when the European Union tariffs went on American-made products, including bourbon, something close to Senate Majority Leader's home state and heart. They're really pointing these things at Congress to say, can you get the president to stop escalating this trade war? And so far, Congress hasn't been able to stop the president from doing it. It's incredibly uncomfortable for many Republicans, particularly those in agricultural production states. You look at the Iowas, you look at the South Dakotas, and those senators are feeling uncomfortable. What's interesting, and we'll talk about some of this with our battleground tracker on Sunday, Anthony Salvanto has been crunching the numbers, polling people to see how much runway are Republican voters going to give the president to say, we trust you'll pull off this deal in the end. So far, no better trade deals, just trade escalation.
CBS News Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan. Still to come, more on immigration with CBS's David Begno at a Texas shelter. And Omar Villafranca is in El Salvador, where many of the undocumented immigrants coming to this country fleeing poverty and violence. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff, as we take a closer look at the immigration issue. In a rare reversal this week, the president said that the U.S. will maintain zero tolerance at the border, but will allow migrant families to stay together temporarily. However, it's not clear if or when children already separated will be able to reunite with their parents. CBS's David Begno reports from a shelter in McAllen, Texas.
That's the New Hope facility behind me. An official with Catholic Charities gave us a heads up and said, listen, here at this facility, they have about 60 children, anywhere between 10 and 17 years old, and some of them have been separated from their parents. The question is, what happens next? You're going to hear from a government official who actually used to run the government's program that takes care of children separated from their parents. He did it under President Obama, and he said, even then and now, the government is not equipped to handle this large number of children, not to mention trying to reunite them with their parents.
Alex Antonio and his 2-year-old son Jeremy were released after being initially detained for the maximum period of 72 hours. The release came around the same time President Trump signed his executive order. The Honduran man told us that while in custody, he heard that families were being separated, and he feared it would happen to him and Jeremy. For the more than 2,300 children already separated from their parents, the president's executive order may not change anything immediately.
There is currently no system in place to reunite children with parents who are in detention.
Bob Carey is an Open Society Fellow. He used to run the Office of Refugee Resettlement under the Obama administration. That is the federal agency responsible for caring for separated children. Carey says ORR's shelter system was designed for minors who arrive at the border alone, typically adolescent boys, and is not really equipped for the influx of infants, toddlers, and young children that were separated from their parents under the president's zero tolerance policy.
This is child abuse being perpetrated by a government.
Early yesterday morning, these girls arrived at a facility in New York City, which Mayor Bill de Blasio says is housing 239 separated children. The mayor says some of them arrived with contagious conditions like chickenpox and lice.
The youngest to come here, they told us, was 9 months old.
The U.S. government tells CBS News it keeps track of children with a unique identifier called an alien number. Name, age, gender, and country of origin are also recorded. Ofelia De Los Santos, an official at Catholic Charities in Brownsville, Texas, says the shelters she's visited are well-run, but...
It's not about how nice a facility is. It's the fact that they're not with their parents. When they go to their beds at night, what do you think they think about?
Ofelia told us that from what she's seen, every time a child gets to a facility like this, they get medical and mental health screenings, if you will. And then the government works to figure out who already lives in the U.S. that's related to them. Government officials have insisted to us we try and find people here in the U.S. who can take them. But that process can sometimes take up to 2 months.
That's CBS's David Begno reporting, and this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Many undocumented immigrants say they're coming to this country because of relentless gang violence in their homelands. Last year, nearly 30% of unaccompanied minors who entered the U.S. illegally came from El Salvador. The Central American country is one of the world's highest murder rates. CBS's Omar Villafranca reports.
Local police tell us one of the biggest problems here in El Salvador is gang violence. And we talked to people who told us they're willing to risk everything just to get to the U.S. border. And we got a firsthand look at everything that they are trying to escape. As darkness fell on El Salvador, we rode along with heavily armed police hunting for members of the notorious MS-13 and Barrio 18 gangs. While we were driving around, officers immediately stopped their trucks and confronted these three men. And they think they are MS-13. They're pretty sure based on what they're wearing, especially shoes. Shoes here, good shoes, Nike shoes, can be expensive, and these guys are wearing them. The police are out day and night, sweeping neighborhoods paralyzed by gang violence. We were with them as they arrested this man, who they say is a member of MS-13, short for Mara Salvatrucha.
Eres Mara?
No.
But he tells us he is not with MS-13.
¿Tienes amigos en Mara?
No.
Do you have friends in MS-13, we asked? No, he told us. Between 60,000 and 100,000 Salvadorians are thought to be involved with gangs. And the evidence of the gangs are everywhere.
We're walking here in this neighborhood, and we found an area where Barrio 18 has basically put a mural up of everybody who died. It says, in memory of the homies. Got their names and gravestones with all their nicknames on there.
Earlier in the day, police took us to San Martin, a neighborhood they say is gang-controlled. These houses were once filled with families, but many have now fled, some of them for the U.S. border.
In Los Angeles.
Jose Rubio lives in Los Angeles, but was deported to El Salvador in 1994. The country needs jobs, he says, so people don't have to get involved in gangs. But this woman says the gangs here even extort businesses. And they find ways to force young people to join. The gangs grab them, she says, and they join out of fear they will be killed.
temporary protected status for El Salvadorian immigrants in the U.S. ends in September of 2019, and that means they may be forced out of the U.S. And there's an estimated 200,000 El Salvadorians living and working in the U.S., and they're sending part of their paycheck here back home. And a lot of people worry that if that money stops coming home, the situation here could get even worse.
That's Omar Villafranca reporting from El Salvador. Meanwhile, CBS's Maria Villarreal went to El Paso, Texas, gauging reaction to the president's executive order this week putting an end to immigration family separation at the border.
While many people in El Paso were relieved by President Trump's new executive order, they also questioned why separating children from families was necessary in the first place.
I'm happy he did it because I was sad to see children taken away. We didn't worry about the immigration problem until he made it a problem.
It never was a problem.
Well, they're not sending their finest, that I can tell you.
President Trump repeated his tough rhetoric regarding Mexican immigrants that began in the earliest days of his campaign.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
El Paso resident Yolanda Torres and her husband Willie used to travel across the border to Juarez, Mexico often before it got too dangerous.
At one time it was so bad out there. You know, lots of shootings, lots of whatever. So we try to avoid Mexico.
They disagree with the separation of children and say they feel safe in El Paso. But they also understand the president must make difficult decisions.
Whatever he says, that's the way it is, really.
You respect the president?
I do respect the president.
Okay.
You know.
You know, I've spoken with a lot of people that actually work directly with immigrants here in the city of El Paso. They still have a lot of questions right now. The hope, though, and the prediction is that the tent city that is currently in Tornillo, that could possibly be used for detention of families to keep them together instead of separating them. Because right now, that tent city is being used for unaccompanied minors.
That's CBS's Maria Villarreal reporting from El Paso, Texas. Still to come, the trade war between the U.S. and China amps up. We'll talk with Jill Schlesinger. And there's a bright future for a long-neglected Detroit landmark, as our friend Jeff Gilbert reports on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Sunday nights, Monday mornings, or Tuesday afternoons. You can listen to 60 Minutes whenever you want with the weekly podcast from CBS News.
How do we know you're telling the truth?
Because I have no reason to lie.
With hard-hitting investigative reports, interviews, and profiles.
Did these documents that you got prove corruption?
Absolutely.
From a variety of CBS News correspondents and contributors.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
For the biggest scoops and the best storytelling, subscribe to the 60 Minutes podcast today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. The European Union is enforcing tariffs on nearly $3.5 billion worth of U.S. products in retaliation to duties that the Trump administration is putting on European steel and aluminum. CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger is here. What is the strategy by the administration here?
I think that President Trump is essentially trying to say, if we make this painful enough for the Chinese exporters, it will bring the Chinese negotiators back to the table. And there are two issues that are really at work here. One is that there is a problem of a trade gap. And the officials that were working on this negotiation prior to this point were trying to get the Chinese to commit to purchase an additional $200 billion of U.S. goods. The Chinese last offer was $70 billion. The other issue that came into play was this practice that the Chinese employ, whereby if U.S. or any foreign company wants to do business and gain access to those billion consumers in China, they had to hand over their technology or partner with a Chinese firm where they essentially would also have to hand over that technology.
Jill, I want you to listen to Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross this week defending the tariffs before the Senate Finance Committee.
They have been harmed by imports to the point that allowing imports to continue unchecked threatens to impair our national security.
But Ross was sharply questioned by Committee Chair Senator Orrin Hatch during that hearing. He's a member of the president's own party. Listen.
These companies are small, Mr. Secretary, but they are important, and they are particularly vulnerable to
to the consequences of the steel and aluminum tariffs.
Pretty strong evidence, Jill, of just how divisive these tariffs are even within the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, look, the steel and aluminum tariffs and the Chinese tariffs are sort of two separate issues, but I think that they kind of conjure up the same thing. The president's and the administration's main thesis is that unfair trade practices put the United States at a disadvantage. Now, in terms of the steel and aluminum tariffs, they are citing a decades-old law which essentially allows the government to impose tariffs if the national security interest is at risk. And so the idea would be, of course, that if, God forbid, you had to go to war, you would need to have a strong domestic producer of steel and aluminum to prepare for that war. I think the problem is that there are plenty of U.S. companies that are relying on the imports from either China or from Mexico, Canada, and the European Union, and that those industries actually employ more people than our steel and aluminum domestic producers themselves.
CBS's Jill Schlesinger with us. I saw an interesting quote the other day. It says, nobody wins a trade war. So I guess on the flip side of this, who stands to lose the most here?
Well, I mean, both economies. I interviewed a woman who is an economist. Her name is Linda Yu. She studies China. And she said she had a little flip on that. The winner of the trade war is both sides when it ends. And the reason that economists are kind of flipped out about this is that they see not so much of a problem in the first iterations of a conflict. So $50 billion back and forth is not going to be the death knell for either the Chinese or the U.S. economy. The steel tariffs back and forth, not going to be a problem because it's still a fraction of the overall economy globally. But as you escalate, the problem becomes that prices start to really move ahead. And there's two essential choices if you're a company. One is the price of the components for, say, my car start to rise. Now I can either eat those costs and become a less profitable company, or I can pass along those costs to my consumer. Really bad news for consumers. So I really don't think that the situation we're in right now is so problematic. I wouldn't even call it a war yet. But what I would say is we've got to keep an eye on this, because sometimes these conflicts can get beyond the officials' ability to control them. They can spin out. And what we don't want to see is at the very moment the U.S. economy is really starting to motor forward here in the end of the second quarter and really towards the second half of the year, we're looking very good from the U.S. economic landscape. To have a self-inflicted wound of a trade conflict that limits that growth would be a real shame.
CBS News Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger, thank you.
Take care.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. In Detroit, a sign of optimism in the auto industry as Ford has bought a decaying train station in downtown Detroit. We get more from WWJ's Jeff Gilbert.
Detroit, if you love Detroit, make some noise right now.
Rapper Big Sean, born the year the train station closed, on hand as Ford begins a four-year process of transforming this century-old building into the centerpiece of a campus where automated vehicles will be developed and new ideas for mobility will be honed. That's quite a change for a building that Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan says became a worldwide symbol of urban neglect.
The Irish Examiner from Dublin, Le Monde from Paris, all came here and wrote about the train station, and the message in all of them was this: the train station is dead and Detroit is dead.
For decades, this building was a target for vandals and urban explorers and the backdrop for apocalyptic movies.
Inside this atrium, you can see what 30-plus years of neglect have done. There's a lot missing from the walls, quite a bit of graffiti, and some broken areas. But you can also see the possibility: huge ceilings, ornate work.
Over the next 4 years, crews will work to make the atrium a public gathering area with shops and restaurants. Bill Ford, who's chairman of the company that bears his family name, says the 5,000 workers that will fill this historic Corktown neighborhood will create the future.
We're making a big bet on our future. What Highland Park, Willow Run, and the Rouge were to the American economy in the 20th century, we hope Corktown will be to the American economy in the 21st century.
The historic train station, one of several buildings where Ford, its suppliers, and startups will work to develop technologies that Ford CEO Jim Hackett says will be tested on the neighborhood streets.
I've been of the mind that as cities look to become more intelligent, more smart, they're better narrowing the question to transportation first. It just affects so many people.
All I want to do is make the city proud.
The last few years have seen a lot of new buildings going up in downtown Detroit and a lot of other historic buildings being renovated. But for lifelong Detroit residents like Big Sean, this is different.
I can't help but to think we all are Henry Ford. You know what I mean? We all can do that. There's no restrictions. There's nothing stopping us. So now's the time. No more excuses, all right? And when you get it all, just remember one thing, that one man could change the world.
Jeff Gilbert for CBS News, Detroit.
Still to come, a lawsuit against the chemical giant Monsanto. You can follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines anytime at CBS News Radio, and I'm at Bill Rakoff. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. Purdue Pharma laid off its entire sales team this week. Now, a former Purdue sales rep reveals that the drug maker downplayed the dangers of opioids, even after pleading guilty to a felony charge of misbranding. A 2007 settlement with the Justice Department included more than $630 million in fines for Purdue. 24 states and more than 400 cities and counties are suing Purdue and its competitors, accusing them of fueling an opioid drug crisis that's killed more than 200,000 people. CBS's Tony DeCopel reports.
Purdue makes OxyContin. You've probably heard of it. It's perhaps the best-known opioid painkiller in America. In 2007, the company admitted to falsely selling the drug as less addictive than rivals. But now a former Purdue salesperson tells CBS News the deceptive sales did not end there.
It was always in the back of my mind that maybe the company had not told us the whole truth when they hired us, when we interviewed, when we went through training. This is our class.
Carol Panera trained for a sales job with Purdue Pharma in 2008.
So this was for the quarter?
Not bad.
She showed us how the company's bonus system put her in a position to make more money by convincing doctors to prescribe higher doses of OxyContin for a wider range of pain.
So bottom line, sell as much as you can.
Sell as much as you can. The idea being that we're trying to expand our reach beyond just pain doctors.
A year earlier, Purdue had admitted it falsely promoted OxyContin as less addictive by, among other means, claiming the drug's slow-release formula did not cause a buzz or euphoria and could be used to weed out addicts. The company said the misstatements ended in 2001.
They made it sound like it was a little bit of a witch hunt on the government's part.
But amid skyrocketing addiction rates and overdoses related to OxyContin, Panera claims the company taught a sales tactic she now considers questionable, saying some patients might only appear to be addicted, when in fact, they're just in pain. In training, she was taught a term for this, pseudo-addiction.
So the cure for pseudo-addiction, you were trained, is more opioids.
A higher dose, yes.
Did this concept of pseudo-addiction come with studies backing it up?
We had no studies. We did not have any studies. That's the thing that was kind of disturbing, was that we didn't have studies to present to the doctors.
You know how that sounds?
I know. I was naive.
A 2015 study published in Current Addiction Reports found no empirical evidence to support pseudo-addiction as a diagnosis. In a statement to CBS News, Purdue said it's confident that its past marketing and sales of its prescription opioid medications have been consistent with the information contained in the FDA-approved label. But the word pseudo-addiction doesn't appear on OxyContin's label. And a spokesperson for the FDA said the labeling is not intended as a discussion of pseudo-addiction.
A big lie is real easy to explain. You know, you just come up with a ridiculous term like pseudo-addiction.
Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter is one of two dozen AGs suing Purdue and other opioid manufacturers. Many of the lawsuits mention pseudo-addiction.
And that maybe is the most disgraceful conduct that we've seen in the whole pattern of disgraceful conduct.
So as far as you can tell, there is no scientific basis for pseudo-addiction?
I reject any notion that there's science behind pseudo-addiction.
Hunter alleges that Purdue and its competitors have caused a devastating public health crisis, costing his state billions of dollars a year.
Do you think this is an epidemic that begins with Purdue Pharma and OxyContin?
Yes.
That's the start of it all?
Yes.
Purdue has reportedly been in discussions with multiple states for a global settlement of lawsuits. But Hunter says he's not interested in joining those talks.
I have no confidence in that process. I have confidence in our lawyers. I have confidence in our laws. I have confidence in a jury of Oklahomans.
Carol Panera, who quit in 2013, says she hopes the drug maker is held accountable.
I think they misrepresented to the public. I think they misrepresented to their salespeople. And, yeah, I think it was just a big charade.
To what end?
To making money.
Do you regret the 5 years you spent with Purdue Pharma?
I'm going to sum it up and say this. I think that was one of the, if not the worst, career decisions of my life.
In February, the company said it would stop training salespeople to sell OxyContin, and this week it announced it would stop making sales calls for the rest of its drugs. Purdue says it's diversifying beyond pain medications, working to develop new drugs to treat cancer and central nervous system disorders.
That's CBS's Tony DeCopel. You're listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. In the first case of its kind to reach trial, a California man dying of cancer is suing Monsanto, the maker of the popular weed killer Roundup, claiming his 2014 cancer was caused by the chemical. Monsanto denies the allegations and said in a statement to CBS News that they have empathy for anyone suffering from cancer, but the scientific evidence shows that the product was not the cause. CBS News legal analyst Ricky Kleeman joins CBS this morning to talk about the case.
The plaintiff, this is a singular plaintiff because he is on the verge of death, and in California you can go first. So he is 46 years old. He worked with Roundup for 2 years when he was a groundskeeper. He says three things. Number one, we have to look at the scientific evidence, and I, the plaintiff, am going to prove to you that this chemical in Roundup is what caused my cancer. Number two, that Monsanto allegedly knew about this, failed to warn, and also buried evidence about it for the public. And number three, if they can actually prove that, which of course is questionable if they can, but if they can, then they're looking for punitive damages.
Monsanto will have its own mountain of data that they will put forward saying that government agencies and other studies show that glyphosate was safe. And so what happens with that?
Well, Monsanto creates this battle of experts, and the literature is clearly on Monsanto's side. They have 800 studies. There was one study in particular that came out of an agency out of the World Health Organization in 2015, and it was the one that said it was a carcinogen. And that was what spurred on this litigation, according to Monsanto. Monsanto says that the plaintiff's science is junk science, but this judge is going to let that science in.
But Johnson's attorney represents thousands of other cancer patients, right?
And I think at least 2,000 of the, let's count them, 4,000. You have cases in San Francisco, a mass of them. You have another mass of them in St. Louis, where Monsanto is located. Those cases, or starting to go with those cases, in October. So this is litigation that's going to continue, but this one's the bellwether, because if, in fact, this plaintiff wins, that creates real momentum for other plaintiffs, and Monsanto would have to rethink its position. However, if this plaintiff loses, Monsanto is in a much better position.
CBS legal analyst Ricky Kleeman on CBS This Morning. Still to come, we'll tell you why some prized Abraham Lincoln personal artifacts may wind up on the auction block on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like
the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Climate's changing. We contribute to it. I've said that 1,000 times.
Democratic National Committee Chair, Tom Perez.
This president has absolutely no moral compass.
Trump cabinet member, Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. At the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois, Abraham Lincoln's legacy is alive, but some of his most prized possessions are in peril, including his hat, gloves, and a fan that belonged to his wife, Mary. It may go to auction because of a historic debt. Here's CBS News correspondent Adriana Diaz.
1,500 artifacts that changed hands through time were eventually bought by a private collector. They finally entered the public sphere in 2007 when the museum's foundation bought the collection for $23 million. But the loan's due next year, and they're millions short.
47 years ago.
At the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois.
Conceived in liberty.
Abraham Lincoln's legacy,
that all men are created equal,
is alive.
It's amazing.
But some of Lincoln's most prized possessions are in peril, like his hat, gloves, quill pen, and a fan that belonged to his wife, Mary. They may go to auction because of a historic debt.
What I sometimes say is he couldn't catch a break in the 19th century. And it seems now he can't catch a break in the 21st century.
Dr. Carla Narowski runs the museum's private foundation, which is more than $9 million short on a $23 million loan used to buy Lincoln artifacts. The money's due next year. And one way to get the money fast, auction off Lincoln's belongings.
May I go in?
Please do.
Illinois State historian Sam Wheeler led us in to their high-security vault.
This is where we keep the greatest treasures that we have.
Treasures that could be sold include...
Wow. That's not what I was expecting.
Well, what
is
were
that
you expecting?
Fur?
It's beaver fur.
Lincoln's iconic hat.
As people called out, "Good evening, Mr. Lincoln," he donned that cap.
And that's how you think those two marks are on the brim?
From well-worn fingerprints.
Also at risk, this wanted poster from Lincoln's assassination in 1865.
That's from the collection, too.
And the gloves that were in his pocket that ill-fated night.
That's his blood right there?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Here and here. I've seen people stand in front of the bloody gloves, stand in front of the stovepipe hat, and they'll weep because that's a physical connection they have with the greatest president in American history.
To save these items, Narowski hopes private donations pour in.
What do you say to folks who say that your organization shouldn't be depending on the public to save it, to bail it out?
We would encourage them to not view it as a bailout, but rather as an opportunity to give back to the man who's done so much for us.
Is this part of the collection that's at risk?
Yes, this is.
She says the financial crisis is partly to blame because donations declined.
Somebody's got some splaining to do.
But that's not enough for Tony Leone, a Lincoln buff who once sat on the board that oversaw the museum.
We really don't have any serious accounting of how much they raise every year and how much they spend.
Do you think this has reached the level of a scandal?
Yes, I really do.
Was there any mismanagement of funds that led you to this mess?
Not any mismanagement of funds.
If you're able to raise the money, how will you feel?
Oh, my God. It'll be the scream that went around the world.
They have to decide whether to go to auction and which items to sell in the next few months. They've even started a GoFundMe page, which has raised more than $7,000. But that's a long way from the $9.7 million they still owe.
That's CBS's Adriana Diaz, and this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Finally, there may be nothing that brings to mind the great outdoors than fishing. And for many who fish, there's nothing better than landing a beautiful rainbow trout. But in Colorado, a disease has threatened the rainbow population. CBS's Barry Peterson has more on a dedicated effort to save the fish.
Joel Evans has been fishing the stretch of the Gunnison River in western Colorado for more than 40 years. Like most anglers in these parts, for him, one species of fish is king, the rainbow trout.
What's it like to have a rainbow at the end of this line?
Oh, they're fun. They tend to be more active. They jump more.
But in the 1990s, that fight shifted to one between rainbow trout and a parasite that invaded Colorado rivers. It causes whirling disease, an aquatic plague, where young fish are deformed, swim in circles, and die of starvation. What kind of numbers and decrease did you see?
Literally a tenfold decrease.
Ever since, Colorado Fish and Wildlife Manager Renzo Del Piccolo has been working to keep the rainbow trout alive through various breeding programs, but at great cost and with only limited success.
The rainbow trout is hugely important to this state.
How important? Is there a dollar number?
Fishing in general, it's estimated over $2 billion to the economy.
Scientists got a major break when they discovered a small, isolated group of rainbow trout immune to the disease in this remote part of the Gunnison. There's disagreement over where they came from, but researchers now agree that their mission is almost biblical. Turn these few fish into many.
Nice work.
That's why biologist Eric Garduño is cruising these waters where the immune trout were discovered, capturing healthy female fish and using them to breed tens of thousands of offspring that are also immune to the illness.
Usually we're going to have about a day when those females' eggs are ready to be spawned and collected by us, so we're out here kind of looking for a needle in a haystack.
They use this spindly apparatus to send a weak electric current through the water that attracts and then stuns the trout.
And then it's just up to our netters to be quick with their net and get those fish out of the water as quick as possible.
The process depends on touch and time. The touch for getting the eggs out of a female.
So usually it'll be about 1,000 eggs per female.
And the time, less than a minute, to use the male trout to fertilize the eggs.
The process of life is going at that point.
The fertilized eggs are brought to a nearby hatchery where they are cultivated and raised into healthy rainbow trout, ready to stock rivers all over Colorado.
We're starting to develop wild fisheries of fish that can reproduce and survive on their own without our help. We know these fish are resistant to the parasite, and we've actually seen a threefold increase in the number of rainbows we have since we started doing that.
While that's good news for Colorado's economy, it means even more to fishermen like Joel Evans, who know the true value of the sport.
It's where it takes you to. Places like this canyon. It's the fun of going, it's the adventure. Sometimes fishing is just kind of part of it.
So with a little luck and a lot of science, they'll be telling fish stories around here for decades to come. Barry Peterson in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison River, Colorado.
And that's the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. Send us your thoughts and story ideas to weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. Check the program online at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. The Weekend Roundup, produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker, our technical supervisor, and Christopher Buckley, our production assistant in New York. Have a great week. I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.